Quaker.com podcast. Today is Wednesday, October 10th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 213. And today is the second in a series of podcasts that I'm doing. I should mention right up front, at this point, I'm not sure I'm going to fit this entire series into podcasts. I may have to stretch this into a third podcast. But what I'm going to be talking about today is the two topics that have come up more frequently here lately in emails and even on the website at badquaker.com. And essentially, I'm paraphrasing the questions, but how are children's rights protected in a free society, and how are law and justice established in a free society? And specifically, or I shouldn't say specifically, but above and beyond what's traditionally considered law and justice, there's also a question about how will contract disputes be settled without, you know, state type courts. So I'm going to get into that just in a minute. I have to throw out our little commercial first for the contest that Michael Dean and I are running right now. In addition to that, I was talking to Cindy, who Cindy's my wife, and she is the owner of badquaker.com website. And she is throwing in with Michael to add a little twist to the contest. So this is going to just warm up the contest a little bit for you. In addition to the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1, Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz DVD, the winner of this contest is also going to get a badquaker.com t-shirt. It's a black, basic black t-shirt with the words badquaker.com in gold across the back. That's gold color, not actual precious metals, unfortunately. So you can win the DVD, Gun Training with Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1, and you can also win a badquaker.com t-shirt to go with it. And so how do you do this? Well, there's two ways. You can go to Facebook, find badquaker.com on Facebook, and that's spelled D-O-T-C-O-M, badquaker.com. Post on the Bad Quaker Facebook page, this quote exactly like this: "I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD." You post that on the badquaker.com Facebook page, and you're automatically entered to win. And if you don't have a Facebook account, you can just email badquaker@badquaker.com. That's badquaker@badquaker.com. And when you do that, put in the subject line DVD, so we know it's not spam, and put the phrase in the body of the email, put the phrase, "I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD." Put that in the body of the email and send it to me, badquaker@badquaker.com. And let me promise you something now, and I generally, as a Quaker, I usually don't speak in absolutes, especially not in reference to the future, but I can speak in absolutes on this. We will not sell, trade, or do anything else stupid or evil with your email address. I promise you that. We will not spam you. We will not bother you. Your email address will be safe. Now, the way the contest is going to work, this coming Sunday, October 14th, this coming Sunday, October 14th, 2012, I will put together all of the names and randomly number them. And then I'm going to call Michael Dean, and Michael Dean is going to give me a number that he chooses. Now, he won't know how I numbered these names. And let's just say there's 100 names, so I'll say, okay, Michael, pick between 1 and 100. And he'll give me a number. He'll randomly choose a number between 1 and 100. And whatever name that I've associated with that number will win the DVD and the t-shirt. Now, I have to give the legal disclaimer here. This is for U.S. resident or U.S. addresses only. We cannot send these outside of the U.S., and they will be coming separately, too, so it'll be two separate packages. So U.S. addresses only. You must be 21 or over. No purchase is necessary, not valid where prohibited by evil overlords. And the contest absolutely ends October 14th, 2012. So get it. You don't have many, you don't have much time, and it only takes a couple minutes to do this, to get to Facebook and log on and put, I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD, or else get that in an email to badquaker@badquaker.com. Do that right away. And I think because I'm going to try to cram so much into today's podcast, I think that's going to be the only announcement for this contest in today's podcast. So be sure and enter into that. And I should mention two other things. One is we are very close to launching the Bad Quaker Forum, and there'll be more details to come about that. If a person is really slick, they might be able to discover where that forum is right now, if you're kind of slick. But anyway, also, I interviewed William Anderson. Bill Anderson is a frequent contributor over at LouRockwell.com, and he's author, he's associate professor of economics at Frostburg State University. And he and I had a wonderful discussion yesterday. I recorded it. And I haven't got to edit it yet, so I need to edit it. I know we did it over Skype, and the connection was kind of in and out, and so there's some blotchiness to it, but so I'll have to clean it up a little bit, but I think it's going to be a pretty good interview. I will probably post that Friday. Yeah, I may post it Thursday. I'm not quite sure how everything will work out, and it may depend on how long this podcast goes and whether or not I can get everything fitted. Anyway, whether or not I can fit it all in, and whether I have to bleed this into a third episode of this particular topic. But one way or the other, I'll try to get, Bill Anderson's interview up either Thursday or Friday. And I might put it up Friday because Friday, it goes on LRN, radio network, and the Friday podcast plays all weekend on LRN.fm. So I may put Bill Anderson's interview so that it loops for the whole weekend because it's kind of the highlight of this week in the podcasts. Okay, so now we've got our business taken care of, and I'll try to jump right back in and get the topic taken care of today. Now, like I said, we're talking about two topics that have come up in emails and on the website at Bad Quaker. How are children's rights protected in a free society, and how are law and justice established in a free society? And I'm also going to talk about contract disputes. Now, before I really get into this, let me just mention in reference to contract disputes. Oddly enough, this morning when I checked my email, I got an email from PayPal telling me that they had made changes in the user agreement. Now, and you get these all the time from different people, from banks and from different organizations. They'll send you an update that that something has changed in their agreement with you. And if you read through one of those, what you're going to find is very often, and this was the case in the PayPal user agreement, there's a clause in there that says that if you have a dispute with PayPal, that it will go through a private arbitrator. Now, what this means is you're essentially, when you use PayPal, you first have to agree to the user agreement, and then when they change the user agreement, they send you a notice like this that the user agreement has changed, then by default, the very next time that you use PayPal again, by default, you are accepting that user agreement that you have been notified of. So that's the way the agreement works with them. And an aspect of this user agreement is this clause that if you have an issue with PayPal, if you have a problem with PayPal that you can't settle in any other way, then you are agreeing to go through private arbitration to have a third party look at the situation and make a decision. And you're also agreeing that the decision of that third party arbitrator is binding and final. So what you're essentially doing is you're saying that I will not use the force and the aggression of the government to go after PayPal. Let's say there's a dispute between you and PayPal, and you feel like they shorted you, you know, $10 or something, and PayPal feels that they did not short you $10. Well, then this is the, you know, according to the user agreement that you've agreed to, you have agreed to have a third party, and they've already secured this agreement with enough people that they already have a contract with a third party arbitrator. And you can find that out from PayPal or whoever it is that you know, your bank or whatever. A lot of companies do this. So they already have a third-party arrangement made, and you're agreeing to use that third party if you have a dispute with them. So if you have a dispute, then you contact that third party. You explain your side. They contact PayPal. They let PayPal explain their side, and they look at the records involved, and you've authorized PayPal to give them the records involved, and then they make a decision, and you've agreed to stick with that decision, and so has PayPal. And in some cases, it's going to come down on your side. If you're right, it'll come down on your side. And if PayPal's right, it'll probably come down on their side. But either way, the third party will decide, and there's no appeal process. You've agreed that whatever the third party group says, that's what you're going to stick with. Now, there are market forces that keep this honest, that keep this whole function honest. Because if PayPal, for example, was regularly ripping off their customers, and then they was going to arbitration with it, and the third party arbitrator was regularly choosing to decide on PayPal's behalf in spite of any evidence otherwise, well, then within the marketplace, word would spread that PayPal is a ripoff and that this third-party arbitrator is a ripoff. So other companies like your bank would refuse to do business with this third-party arbitrator because they have a bad reputation. They can be bought out by a company, and therefore, like if your bank was going to have a similar agreement with another bank, and they do, banks between themselves have these agreements that they will go through a third-party arbitrator. Well, they're not going to hire that arbitrator that they know can be bought off. So that forces the market itself forces that arbitrator to be honest. And the market itself drives PayPal to be as honest as possible, because if the reputation goes out that they're ripping people off all the time, then pretty soon there would be no PayPal. And that's how contract disputes are settled without the force of government. Because, you know, here's what's not going to happen. PayPal is not going to send an IRS agent out to your house and show up with a SWAT team and, remove you from the house and confiscate your furniture. PayPal is not going to do that. PayPal is also not going to force you to do business with them if you've been ripped off by PayPal and you don't want to do business. They're not going to come to you and say, no, you don't understand. We're going to do business with you. Well, you know, that's kind of what the government does. Because if you say, wow, you know, I'm paying all this money in taxes, and they're taking this money and they're buying these drones and they're droning wedding parties in third world countries, and I don't really like this. So what I'm getting back for my money is called protection. I'm being protected from these super, super poor people in third world countries that live in mud huts. Somehow they're a threat to me, the government is telling me. So the government has to spend a few million dollars to kill a wedding party. And I'm paying for that, and I'm told that's a good deal. I don't think I want to participate in that particular purchase, so I think I'm going to stop paying for that. Well, the government is the kind of a merchant that will come out and we'll use a SWAT team and we'll kick down your door and we'll say, at some point, if you don't pay your taxes, I mean, you know, others have gone through this. Larkin Rose has gone through this. Stefan Molyneux has gone through this. They start out, they send you a letter. You ignore that, they send you a meaner letter. You ignore that, they send you another letter. It's got even more aggressive words in it. Eventually, they're going to send a guy to your house. And if you won't cooperate with him, they'll send a group of guys to your house. And you will cooperate with them. Otherwise, you'll end up like that dead Marine in, was it New Mexico, that they shot like 70 times? That's what happens if you, ultimately, if you try to resist a SWAT team. They will kill you. It's guaranteed. That's what they do for a living. SWAT teams are the enforcement thugs of the government that go out and use the absolute fist of the state to kill people that resist. And they don't care why you're resisting. They don't care if you're resisting because the SWAT team has the wrong address. They don't care if you're resisting because you're morally right in the situation. They don't care. Once they get there, they are as dumb as the bullets they shoot. They just fly out the barrel and kill whatever's on the other end. And that's how the government provides you services. But PayPal doesn't provide services like that, and neither does the private arbitrator that takes care of contract disputes between you and PayPal. PayPal will never force you like that. You see, that's the difference. Okay, now, I kind of sidetracked myself here, so let me say where I'm coming from on my sources, because my sources today are slightly different than yesterday. I'm still relying on For a New Liberty, the Libertarian Manifesto by Murray Rothbard, and there will be links to these things at badquaker.com in the show notes for today. I'm still relying on that wonderful book, Chaos Theory, by Robert P. Murphy. And there's a great article, and this is really good and really handy for having on the internet. If you're in a chat with somebody, or you're on a forum with somebody, or whatever, and you want a reference to something, there's a great article called The Obviousness of Anarchy by John Hasness, and I'm probably mispronouncing his name. I've read it a million times, but I've never heard it pronounced once. So John Hasness, I think. Hasnas. Again, the links are in the show notes for today at badquaker.com. He is the associate professor of law at Georgetown University School of Law, and he has a long string of credentials, and he has written this wonderful article that's on the internet, and you can get the link there in the show notes, The Obviousness of Anarchy. Now, in addition to those things that I mentioned yesterday, I'm also going to rely on some stuff by Roderick Long. If time permits today, I'll put in a little sound clip of him giving a lecture, of Roderick Long giving a lecture. And also, Roderick Long has a wonderful article called Privatization Viking Style, Model or Misfortune. And in it, and there'll be a link to in today's show notes that actually go back to a Bad Quaker .com webpage where we've reprinted his entire article. This was from, I believe, last year when I put that up on Bad Quaker. But it's a great article. It's well worth a few minutes to read, and it's talking about Iceland and the anarchical society that was present in Iceland for hundreds of years. And they had legal arbitration of every kind. They had laws that were enforced. They even had capital punishment, which you might agree with or disagree with. Capital punishment is not the point. The point is they had capital punishment without a coercive state, without a government, without a government as we traditionally think of government. Now, when we say that, you know, the anarchist can accept a voluntary government, and that's what they had in Iceland. They had a voluntary government. The anarchist can accept that. The anarchist just can't accept a coercive government, and that's really the difference here. So we can have things like law. We can have things like arbitration. We can have things like, protection of individual rights. We can have all these things in a voluntary government. Voluntary governments just no longer exist. Okay, I'm going to break, so stick with me. I'll be right back.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you. Okay, thanks for sticking with me. Now, yesterday's podcast was my attempt to show the depth of the failure of the state. The very things that we're told can't exist without the state, the very things that we're told hold society together, those things are the things that the state fouls up the most. And two examples are the protection of children and providing justice. Now, I didn't quite get as far as I had hoped that I would, so I'm going to have to finish up yesterday's podcast before I can even start today's. And so that's why I said earlier that that this may bleed into a third part in this series. But I think it's worth it. I think it's worth spending the time on because, you know, as often as we face these questions and as often as we dodge the question, and I'll touch that in a second too, as often as we dodge these questions, And sometimes we dodge it in an honest way, but sometimes we really need to face these questions too and really look at it and really explain, especially to newer people, that, you know, how these things really can work out in a free society. Okay, so I want to recap here. This is what I read this yesterday, but I'm going to read it again today because it's really important to the topic. Always remember these critical factors when considering a truly free society. Number one, the current system is a complete failure, so much so that no system at all is preferable to this failed system based entirely on aggression. Number two, by the very nature of a free society and a free market, no one solution would ever be universally accepted. Now, we can only suggest possibilities, but we can't absolutely say it's going to be like this or it's going to be like that. Think about, on this point, think about someone like Jules Verne. Back in the 1800s, Jules Verne could see that there would be things like, you know, at the time there were only blimps, hot air balloons. But he foresaw a thing like a Zeppelin, a rigid-framed flying machine. He could see that in his mind. He didn't exactly know the details because the Zeppelin hadn't been invented yet. But he saw the possibility of this in his mind. And he saw other things that didn't exist yet, like underwater craft. He had the imagination to realize, sure, there had been experimentations on that in the past, but he saw the problems in the past that they had, which specifically is propulsion, and he realized that that problem would be taken care of. But he didn't know the details, and he didn't need to know the details. All he knew was that this was something the market would demand, and this is something that the market would produce. And this is very much the same way with the anarchist that looks to the future. We don't necessarily need to know all the details going into this, but we believe in the market and we know that whatever the market demands, the market will produce. We know the market will demand justice, and therefore the market will produce justice, and the market will demand the protection of children. And so the market will produce the protection of children. The only thing that can interfere with that process is an aggressive government. Okay, so let me get back to my list. That was number two. Number three is the state is an anomaly in the human experience. Humans have survived ice ages that have lasted longer than the state has existed. And the state is a very temporary condition of mankind. And I said yesterday it's like a head cold. It's a hindrance to everything we do, everything we think, everything we say. It's always right there giving us pressure. And the bad thing about the state and how it's not like a head cold is that it actually has the potential, unless we reject it, which I believe we will. I believe the state will fail and humanity will reject the state. But if humanity doesn't reject the state, then the ultimate logical end of the state is the extinction of mankind. If you just think through what the state is, what it does, how it feeds, then the logical end of the state is either a collapse and abandonment by mankind, or the complete destruction of mankind. And I believe we will choose the death of the state and the life of mankind rather than the other way around. But I think also there are people who their religion of the state is so deep in their minds that they would be willing to push that button and kill humanity rather than see the state die. But of course, if humanity dies, then the imagination that creates the state is dead as well. I did a thing a while back comparing the state to the id monster in the movie Forbidden Planet. If you're not familiar with that, you should go back through the archives and search Forbidden Planet. Okay, now so let's look at these three factors. The way it's going now, I'm almost guaranteed to go into a third day talking about this topic. Okay, so let's look at these three factors. The first one, the current system is a complete failure, so much so that no system at all is preferable to the failed system, to this failed system that's based entirely on aggression. I said yesterday that child protective services in the U.S. is the single greatest physical threat to children living in the U.S. But I didn't really give you a lot of, I gave a couple of examples, but I didn't really give you a lot of proof of that. So what I want you to do is I want you to go to badquaker.com. And I want you to follow the link from today's show notes to the wiki entry on Child Protective Services. Once you get on the wiki and once you get to the page for Child Protective Services, scroll down to the section called Criticisms and read that whole section. It's in several parts, but read that whole section on criticisms. And keep in mind that wiki is forced to be as neutral as possible, but as truthful as possible. And it's forced to do that by market pressures. Also, if Wiki was publishing something blatantly untrue about the government, the government would do something about it. So the fact that it's there, published by Wiki, like it is, means the government can't dispute what's in that section. So do that. Go to badquakernot.com to the show notes for today's show. Hit the link to the wiki page for Child Protective Services. Scroll down and read the criticism section for yourself. The other thing I want you to do, if you don't think that I'm correct when I say that Child Protective Services in the U.S. is the single greatest physical threat to children, if you think I'm wrong or mistaken or whatever, go to the show notes for today, and there's a link there to a book called Out of Control, Who's Watching Our Child Protection Agencies by Brenda Scott. And this is an older book. If I recall, it's from like the mid-90s or something. But it's a good book. And click that link. That link goes over to Amazon, and scroll down Amazon until you get to the comments section, the reviews of this book. And read the reviews of this book on Amazon. Even if you don't buy it, just read the reviews. Amazon typically shows two or three reviews, and then you can click on the button and read the rest of the reviews. Spend some time and read those reviews on this book, and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's called Out of Control, Who's Watching Our Child Protection Agencies by Brenda Scott. Click on that link on badquaker.com and just read the reviews of that book. Now, I found it interesting that Brenda Scott used the phrase, who's watching our child, because that's kind of a, I don't know if she realized it or not, but that's kind of a fallback onto the Selene's Laws. And I've done several podcasts talking about Selene's Laws. And again, there's a link in today's show notes to the wiki page for Selene's Laws. But one of Selene's Laws, Selene's first law, is that we have, if we decide that we are going to have government watchers, then what ends up happening is that when we have government watchers, soon they get out of control. And then the watchers need watchers. Somebody needs to watch the watchers to keep them honest. But the problem with that is, the watchers that watch the watchers soon get out of control and need watchers. So we need watchers to watch the watchers that watch the watchers. And pretty soon those watchers, the power gets to them and they get out of control. And so we need watchers to watch the watchers that watch the watchers that watch the watchers. You see how that goes? Now, usually a government collapses before it gets that ridiculous, but they tend to move in that direction. So with child protective agencies, people, busybodies, statists, people who worship at the idol of the government, which is, you know, the state is a god that they worship, a man-made god, and people who worship this god see that there's a problem. Some children are abused. There's a problem. It's a real problem. But they don't look for a cause. What is causing this problem? They don't do that. Instead, they rely on government. How will government fix this problem? How does government fix every problem? It comes rushing in with an agency that's susceptible to the things that every government agency is susceptible to. This agency comes running in and uses aggression and theft and attempts to fix a problem. A problem that's a family problem, a problem with protecting children, the government attempts to fix that problem by using aggression and theft. And so that's what child protective services in the U.S. are. And then, of course, remember, if you recall yesterday, I went to lengths to explain regulatory capture and self-selection bias. But those two economic rules apply in every government agency. So when you create a government agency to protect children and regulatory capture and self-selection bias kick in immediately, and pretty soon that agency is out of control because the only tool it owns is aggression and theft. So it gets out of control. So pretty soon you have to have somebody to watch that agency because the agency gets out of control. So then you have watchers over that agency. And that hasn't taken place yet in America. They're attempting to do that. That's the state's only answer, is to put another agency to watch the agency. And so eventually there will be attempts. There will probably be some kind of federal agency to watch the state agencies that watch the children. And then there's going to have to be, and it'll get corrupted too by the same economic pressures, by regulatory capture and self-selection bias. And so then there's going to have to be an agency to watch that agency. And you see how that works like that. Click on the link in the show notes today for Selene's Laws if you're not familiar with that, and read Selene's First Law, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Now, yesterday I also said that government-mandated schools in the U.S. are a constant and ongoing contradiction to the myth that children in the U.S. have any rights whatsoever. Children in the U.S. have no rights. That's not to say that they're not born with rights. That's not what I mean. What I mean is all rights are denied to all children in the U.S. presently. School itself is an absolute denial of the rights of children. School itself, which is mandatory in the U.S. in one form or another, even homeschooling, If the government realizes that you're not, let's say you take your children out of school and you're not homeschooling, then you better watch out, because most places in the U.S., they're going to come after you, or, you know, as soon as they find out about you, that is. So school itself is aggression, making children, forcing them to sit still, come here, go there, forcing them to be in a specific place at a specific time. This is all based on aggression, and it's all based on violating their rights. School in the U.S. is a 12-year prison sentence, plus or minus a year or two for good behavior. It's forced attendance, which is the same as forced imprisonment. It's forced labor. Think about what children are forced to do at school. They're forced to lug around a lot of books. Have you seen how much homework children are forced to do nowadays in public schools in the U.S.? So they're lugging around 40, 50 pounds of books every day. Well, maybe not that much, but 20, 30 pounds of books every day, just trying to accomplish their homework. they go into physical education, or, you know, some form of physical education is required in most public schools. And what is that really? It's forcing the children to do things like, you know, push-ups or whatever. It doesn't matter. You're still forcing them. It's essentially forced labor, no matter how you want to look at it. And now you violate the children's right to speak. You violate their ability to have free speech. They can't talk to their friends whenever they feel like it. They can't express whatever emotions that they're feeling. They can't express their opinion about their teacher, about the principal, about the school itself. They can't express their opinion. They'll be punished if they do. The right to move around freely, to eat when they feel like eating, to go to the bathroom when they feel like going to the bathroom. All of these rights are gone. Their right of property is gone. Once you send a kid to school, they own nothing. Yes, you think that cell phone that you paid $400 for that's in their pocket, once they get to school, it belongs to the school. You don't believe me? Have them take it out in front of a teacher and see what happens. The school owns everything about that child, including the child, when they go to school. And if you don't believe they own the child, go down and just try to walk in and take your child out without asking permission. See what happens. Some schools, you literally might get shot. Especially in an emergency situation, you go down to a school in an emergency situation and try to pull your kid out. They probably won't even let you see your child. And there's forced socialization of all different kinds. It's probably not as bad now as when I was a kid, I'm assuming this. But when I was a child, I was forced to hold hands and dance with people that I didn't want to hold hands with and people I didn't want to dance with. I was forced to take dancing classes in school, and I was forced to hold hands with people I didn't want to hold hands with. How is that not sexual abuse? If I'm being forced into, as a child, if I'm being forced into a mating ritual against my will, how is that not sexual abuse? But that's what happens in public schools. So the conclusion I came to, and I say all that because I didn't really lay that argument out yesterday. I just kind of touched on it a little bit. So I'm pulling out all the corks and just letting everything fly today. Now, I want to challenge you on this. I want to challenge you as my listener. Think about schools. Think about school districts. Think about the hierarchy of schools, even private schools, even religious schools. Think about the whole hierarchy that goes on there. And ask yourself if you can spot regulatory capture and self-selection bias. I doubt that I'll have time to go into the definitions today, but you can get those from yesterday's podcast, or you can look them up in Wikipedia. Regulatory capture and self-selection bias. That's your homework. Think about your own school district. Think about the schools near you. If your children are in public schools, think about those schools. If you homeschool or whatever, think about how public schools work, or even private schools. Think about them. And think for yourself. Come up with examples for yourself of how self-selection bias and regulatory capture interfere with the process of educating children in a state-styled school. Okay, once again, stick with me. I'll be right back. BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com. Folks, I want to talk to you about Survival Gear Bags. Survival Gear Bags is about more than just great gear bags and survival kits. Check out their website by clicking the banner at BadQuaker.com. Survival Gear Bags has everything from Wise Food storage products to tactical equipment to camping supplies to clothing and rain gear to hydration and purification systems to books and DVDs. Plus, Survival Gear Bags is known for its service, and it's owned and operated by people who understand and adhere to the zero aggression principle. So get over to Survival Gear Bags and get the stuff you need. Okay, thanks for sticking with me. Now, And again, I'm still just finishing yesterday's podcast, really. The current system, this is point number one. The current system is a complete failure, so much so that no system at all is preferable to this failed system based entirely on aggression. And now we take that, I was talking about schools, I was talking about children's rights. And so let's take this into the legal system. Yesterday, I used the example, I can't remember exactly how I worded it. So I'll say today, the example of, let's say Bob breaks into Jerry's house and the cops come and let's say, Bob is found guilty. You know, the cops figure out that Bob did it. Bob is arrested. Bob is tried. Everything goes the way that you're supposed to do it according to the state system. Bob is found guilty and, Bob is thrown into jail. Bob serves his time, blah, blah, blah. We're told that that is justice. And as I said yesterday, that's nothing even remotely resembling justice. So if you're not sure about this argument, I've done it several times and you can go back and listen to it yesterday. But the one thing that I left out was this one aspect. When Bob goes to trial for breaking into Jerry's house, the government will call this the people versus Bob. When Bob goes to trial for breaking into Jerry's house, the government will call this the people versus Bob. The people. Not Jerry. The people. Just think about that, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Now, one other thing that I didn't talk about yesterday was that the current system of justice looks at rich people different than it does the poor. If you're rich, you may not realize this. Even if you're moderately wealthy, or even if you're just comfortable in doing well, you may not recognize, or you may not even believe, that rich people are treated differently by governmental justice systems than the way that they treat the poor people. But it's an absolute fact. And there are lots and lots and lots of very prominent cases in this. And it's not only rich and poor. Sometimes famous people are not all that wealthy, but famous people are treated quite different than the poor are treated. As a matter of fact, if a poor person has any kind of minor violation that gets them on the radar of the local prosecutor, they don't get off that radar. They will be a constant source for the local police and prosecutor to harvest money from. And that's exactly what it is. They get some kid. I did an interview last year, and maybe I should bring that back up again. I did an interview with a guy who got caught in the justice system when he was in high school. He was just about to turn 18, and so he was tried as an adult. And it was a silly little thing where no one was harmed. But yet, what he did was considered by the government to be a felon, and he could never get off their radar. And for years, he would be stopped and searched. He would have to deal with every traffic stop. The local police knew him, so he was constantly being harassed by them. And, you know, Harvey Silvergate has a book called Three Felons a Day, where he lays out the argument that no matter who you are or what you do, the odds are if the government wants you, they'll get you. Because on average, there are just so many laws, and they're written so vaguely that on average, we break about three felons a day if we just live a normal life and do regular stuff. And so if the government wants you bad enough, they can get you for something. And that's the deal with like the person that I interviewed last year, who is not a rich person, who is not from a rich family, not noteworthy in any way, and, you know, not some socialite or not on TV or anything like that. And so they get him on the radar. He's done one silly thing that didn't hurt anybody. And they just hound him and hound him and hound him. And year after year after year goes by, and they find silly violations, minor things that they get him on, and they keep him in the system, and they keep him paying into the system constantly. He needs counseling on this, or counseling, you know, government mandated counseling on this, or, you know, court mandated counseling on that. And it just goes on and on. And he constantly has to pay and pay and pay into these systems. They are harvesting his wealth from him because he got on their radar to begin with. And they don't do that to rich people. They do it to poor people. And poor people know this. And I mentioned yesterday also that the legal system is made up of evil people and disinterested people. That's pretty much, and that's true for Child Protective Services as well. And there are exceptions to every rule. But that's the Barney and Andy thing. The Andys are pushed out and the Barneys are rewarded. And this system goes, or this goes through system-wide. In every government agency, this takes place. The evil and the disinterested are constantly pushed forward and rewarded for their behavior by government. But the really, the good-hearted, the honest, those are pushed out in any kind of government situation, and more so in law enforcement. The evil and the disinterested. If you try to talk to a cop and you say, you know, hey, and let's assume it's a good cop, and you're talking to him, you're like, you know, some of these laws are really stupid. And he'll agree. Yeah, I know. But he's disinterested in the sense that he doesn't really care. He's just doing his job. He doesn't care. He doesn't think about that he's acting immorally when he does his job. He doesn't think about that he's acting immorally when he enforces immoral laws. He simply doesn't care. He's disinterested. And because of that disinterest, and because that disinterest is systematic through the system, and then you add those within the system that are truly evil, and you have those who are evil and those who just don't care, and they're still willing to do their job. And so that's what we have. And so when it comes to law and justice, we have to overcome this myth that the state is the source of law and justice. As I've made the argument before, the state is the opposite. The state cannot provide you with law and justice because the state is based on injustice and the state is based on aggression and theft. So how can something that is based on aggression and theft produce law and justice? There was an old joke about the Soviet Union, and it's been told 100 different ways. And it goes like this. Two old women wait in line for bread, which was a common thing in the old Soviet Union. Two old women wait in line for bread, and they wait for hours. And one old woman looks at the other old woman and says, "It's terrible. We have to wait all day in line for one loaf of bread." And the second old woman says, "At least we can get bread. In the West, governments don't even make bread." Now, you see, there's this thing that happens in a person's mind when you become dependent on the government to supply you with something. And the government propaganda constantly tells you that you must depend on the government for that thing. Within a couple generations, pretty much everybody believes that the only way you can get that thing is if you're given it by the government. And that's where we're at on law and justice. And that's where we're at on Child Protective Services. Somehow, generations have gone through enough times that it's believed that law and justice can't be found if the state doesn't provide it to us. But what you have to remember is that some form of functional law has existed in every culture prior to the state's interference. State interference in law in most of Europe and in all of North America didn't really start to take hold until into the 1600s. There, you see, around 1600, and I've made this argument before, there was a metamorphosis in the state in the West. Now, things like this, again, China and India is a different argument altogether. The Middle East is a different argument altogether. In Western culture, though, beginning about the year 1600, a metamorphosis began taking place in the state. And it began the birth of what you might call the corporate state. We began leaving behind the old monarchical state, and this new corporate state began to be birthed about 1600. And one of the very first things that this new corporate state began to absorb or began to usurp was a law. Now, law still exists in many places where there's no state. Even today, if you get into the depths of the Amazon, or if you get into different places in South America, very few places are left in Africa that are truly free. Probably the largest population of non-state people is still located in Zomia, in the uplands of Southeast Asia. Estimates are that there's somewhere around 30 million people still living in Zomia in upland Southeast Asia that are stateless. And those people still have functional law. They still have appeals processes within their own society for arbitration. They have they have contract dispute resolution. These things have functioned right along without a state in their society. And prior to 1600, that's the way it was through almost all of Europe. Some exceptions in southern Europe, but mostly throughout, especially northern Europe, pretty much all law was private. Until the state began to absorb it in the 1600s. And keep in mind, too, that all true law, all traditional law before state interference, was based on questions of property and aggression. That was everything it had to do. It was discovering who owned the property and who initiated the aggression. That was pretty much what all law was based on. And then it was just a matter of figuring out what the damages were, figuring out if anything needed to be repaid, or if there needed to be, if there was some grievance that was created that where something needs to be paid back in one way or the other. That's what all law was about. And that was all, it was all private between individuals, and so it could be settled between a third-party arbitrator. And oftentimes, this was some kind of respected member of the community. It was not someone that had anything to do with the state. And all of this was done voluntarily. Murray Rothbard has done extensive work talking about ancient Ireland and how their system in ancient Ireland of voluntary arbitration and how the clans worked among themselves to settle these disputes like this. Also, Roderick Long, I mentioned him before, has talked in depth about Iceland and about the anarchical society in Iceland where there was all these different aspects of law without a aggression-based state. And now I've gone almost through the entire podcast, and I haven't come even close to explaining how an anarchical society would provide these things. I'm still just kind of tearing apart the other, but I am trying to show you that in other places and in other times, all these services have been provided voluntarily without the aggression of the state. And I mentioned before about, the state versus, was it Bob? Is that who I said the people versus Bob. I want to read something to you. And this is actually, I'm pulling the quote right out of the actual case. This is a quote, the people versus Charles Manson. Appellants Charles Manson, Patricia Kernwinkle, and Susan Adkins were indicted by a grand jury on 7 counts of murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. Appellant Leslie Van Houten, was indicted in 2 of the same 7 counts of murder and in the conspiracy count. A jury found all appellants guilty as charged and further found the murders to be of the first degree. Now, when we look at this, we see it's the people versus Charles Manson. That's lie number one. When it comes to the state, this is lie number one. Front and center, the lie that the state, that the central religion of the state is based on this one lie, that the state and the people are the thing. That's the essence of the lie that causes the state to exist. If you can get it in your mind that the state is not the people, the state is the myth that some people can lord over the rest of us. That's what the state really is. The state is not the people. The government is not the people. The government is made up of people, among other things. But that lie that the people are the state and that the state is the people. somehow, if you believe this, and if you look at this Charles Manson case, very famous, somehow we're told that these murders harmed the state. Therefore, it's the people versus Charles Manson. In other words, the state versus Charles Manson. It was the state prosecuting Charles Manson. It was the state against Charles Manson. So somehow these murders harmed the state? How is that? How is that possible? How did these murders harm the state? Well, the answer is because the victims of the murder were the property of the state. That's lie number two. That's the second most important lie in believing the myth of the state. That the state owns property. And among the property that the state, remember the state's not a person. It's not even a collection of people. It's a myth. It's a belief. It's a religious concept. The state is a belief. How can a belief be harmed? How can a belief own anything? But that's the second lie of the state, that the state can own property. And specifically, the property that was harmed was the human being. So by the very statement, the people versus Charles Manson, is a statement that the state owns the victims of Charles Manson's murders. The actual victims are brushed aside. They're meaningless to the state. The state is declaring with every single trial that the state owns the property that was harmed by the incident. Charles Manson, in this case, harmed state property when he killed those people, or when he had those people killed. That's what the state, that's part of the state's lie. And that's what has to be shot down. You have to get that out of your mind. Under the current system, under the current aggression-based system, the greatest hindrance to justice is the state. So what's the solution? Well, once again, I'm running out of time here, so I can't get to the solution. So I've got to tease you to come back again. Come on back tomorrow, and we'll talk about the solution. We'll talk about how we can have a free society, and how a free society can provide everything that the market wants. And what do we need? If the market being all of us together, the market is actually made up. The market is the people. The market is the desires of the people. That's what the market really is. You see, the state is like a false god. It's asking you to believe that the state is the people. But in reality, the market is the will of the people. And as the market wants something, if the market wants justice, if the market wants secured rights for children, if the market wants flying machines, if the market wants submarines, if the market wants anything, then people will have an incentive to produce that. If the market wants roads, and what is the market again? The market is the will of people. If people want roads, then someone will do everything they can to fill that need. And why will they? Because it lines their pocket. Because they can make money doing it. They can have a more comfortable life working to provide people with a road than if they didn't do that. So people make choices every single day to do things for other people so that they themselves can have something out of it. That's why we make the decisions that we make. And even decisions that are based on charity, even when we say, I'm going to donate my time to this particular organization, and I'm going to go and feed the needy or help the needy in some way, or I'm going to go and, help rescue people that were in this tragic natural disaster. And when you dedicate your time and you dedicate your efforts to doing things like that, why do you do it? Why do you do that? Why do you give money to a charity? Why do you do that? Because it feels good. The reward for doing good is feeling good. This is nature's way of rewarding mutually beneficial behavior. Nature will reward you within yourself. And it's the same way within the market. The shoemaker, the cobbler, does not make shoes. And nowadays it's a little different, but that's the old classic argument. The shoemaker does not make shoes because he gets a thrill out of making shoes. He makes the shoes because he can sell the shoes and put food on his table. He doesn't make the shoes out of some obligation to society. He doesn't make the shoes because somebody puts a gun to his head and says, "You're the shoemaker and you will make shoes." Now, in a state, he might do that. But he'll never produce the kind of shoes that he will, under aggression, he'll never produce the kind of quality of shoes that he would produce if he was doing it for himself. But when he's producing shoes so that he can sell them and make money and buy better things for himself and buy better things for his family, then his selfishness helps the whole community. His selfishness, wanting food, wanting money, wanting a better life, that desire for himself to satisfy the needs of himself actually improve the lives of other people, because somebody else doesn't know how to make shoes, or they're too busy growing wheat, or they're too busy, you know, fixing roofs. And the shoemaker doesn't really have any particular inclination to work on roofs. So that's why he makes shoes. But the guy on the roof can't do his job unless he's got shoes. And he doesn't buy shoes because he enjoys shoes. He buys the shoes and pays what he paid for the shoes so that he can do his roofing job and keep money in his own pocket. He's doing it for his own selfish reasons. And that's what drives the market. That's what drives voluntarism. That's what creates innovation. And the government, under any circumstances involving aggression, can never motivate that. No matter how much it tries, it can never create that kind of motivation in the individual. Only the selfish desires of saying, I want the best for me and my family, only that can drive the market and produce these things, whether they be shoes, roofs, roads, justice, or security, or anything else. The only real way to honestly provide those things is to allow the market to do it. Folks, thank you very much for sticking with me. Be sure and catch tomorrow's episode, where I'll go into the solution, and we'll finish this up in the third episode. And for more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much. Goodbye, folks. We'll be right back.